Assume you're familiar with the affiliations between Esalen and remote viewing and CIA and stuff. I mean,
oh yeah.
Jeffrey Kripal will deny them.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So one of my preoccupations, and you probably could not have picked it up really, in terms of as I'm exploring all this stuff, and of course it goes back to my formative experiences as I directly explored with occult Yorkshire, and it's the question, you know, can I identify the benign from the malign? Am I able to discern malignance when I see it, even when it's under the guise of benevolence? Now, putting it in those very stark terms, very clear how that would be more than a dilemma for a child.
Right.
But it's been sort of telescoped outward in terms of all this research I do. So whether it's Whitley Strieber or Jeffrey Kripal, or whether it's Crowley, whether it's Esalen, or there are all these different individuals and groups that have this ostensibly benign appearance and focus, and there are individuals involved ditto, and it seems inescapable that some of them are not what they seem, and some of them are consciously complicit with horrendous criminal activities, but some of them are not.
Right.
So,
and how do you discern?
How do you discern? Is it important to do so? Obviously, it's important to me. Is this something that you've found yourself wrestling with also in terms of moving through these waters?
Absolutely, and I think that was that's why I have said in some of my comments to you, Jason, that you have a maturity that is not usually found in someone as young as yourself. Because I think a lot of these things that you've come up with are through life experience, not getting a degree in this or whatever, but they're actually through living your background, how you were brought up, and how you move through that, and how you're in a different, whole different place, and the fact that you have taken on a whole new persona, more or less, all of that is a huge leap of maturity that to me you are able to discern. You know, I'm sure that. I don't know how one does that except intuitively, Jason. And I think that either comes through life experience, or it's something that it's a special gift. But I do think that that's how you get through it. You have to discern, you have to intuit, you have to try to figure out who's on first and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And we're, you know, often betrayed, but that betrayal also is another more information.
Yeah, true. That's true. I think when you're referring to the extent that what I do is useful to others and as provides a service, as you put it, like, I think that that's very central to it, that there are many, I mean, in a sense, it's everybody, but there are people who are particularly acutely aware of their lack of discernment and their need to develop discernment in terms of sorting the seeds within their own selves, in terms of what's been installed in them that's false conditioning and what's real, but then also outside of themselves as a sort of mirror for that process, like, you know, what can I trust in out there? Which signals that are coming to me are true?
Right.
And nourishing, and which are not. So you had your guru experience, I had mine. That was certainly what came to mind in terms of a life experience that really helped me to recognize the need for discernment, to be able to refer to some inner compass to tell me what's what. So then as a writer, like, this has become, it's become what I do, like a deconstruction of narratives.
Right.
So I'm
Well, that's
Yeah.
interesting because my friend, the one I want you to research, he deconstructed religions.
Yeah.
That was his, and also art. He's an art. He's a very good artist, a fine artist also. But it's all about the whole deconstruction, which, in the art movement was kind of a negative thing. I mean, you tell people you're a deconstructionist, and they just kind of glaze over. Because it wasn't even, most people don't even know what period of the art that was. But I think that, I really think that, I noticed that I don't, you, of course, you don't give people's age for the most part, although sometimes you share, because I know you've shared your 49 or something like that. But a lot of your guests are quite young.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I'm always surprised that now I think a lot of it is because they've had this experience where they've had conversations with people they never would have met except for on the internet. Especially if they're out in the sticks or, living where someone where, Greer is living or, I mean, just they would never be having conversations like this. And I think it's wonderful that, that you are reaching some young people. That's, so I think that is probably, I mean, if, what are we here for, Jane? I mean, that's like, all right, what gives your life meaning? Is there any meaning to this? Maybe this is totally existential. I mean, we won't know anything until we lose everything. We seem to be on that path, in
Yeah.
but
Well, yeah. I wasn't sure if
really.
that. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was a rhetorical question or not. So, because you paused, so I thought, oh, am I gonna have to answer this? Yeah. So, I mean.
You feel like this is what you're supposed to be doing, Jason?
Yes, and not 24/7, but
No, absolutely.
it's moving more, from 24/7 feeling of not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, it's moving gradually towards the opposite of that. And really that's not a mental, there is this mental element that's ticking boxes and saying, you did good there and you're getting validation here and so on. But really what is actually of that is more substantial, and I would say maybe even infinitely, but I try not to use that word, but it's immeasurably more substantial, is a sensation of being that is in it is in the body, at least. The body is definitely able to experience it in the way that the mind isn't. I don't think it's restricted to the body, but there's a sensation of well-being that is like a very soft signal that gets stronger, and I do think it is nourished by connecting to others from that place and to that place in others, that somehow there's a reinforcement of the signal that can
Right.
happen through connecting, through these connections.
Right.
And that, so, but what I was getting at a moment ago, or trying to, was that there is also this mental level, which is that I am seeking validation. I hope in ways that are less and less neurotic, so that it's not just I want my daddy and my mother's approval because I didn't get it, but also, well, I'm an investigator here, and I'm actually out on a limb a lot of the time. So, then if I have an opportunity to, and it's happening more and more, to speak to people who seem to be more knowledgeable directly than I am, and maybe even were insiders or at least know some of these people, and they're not calling me crazy,
Right.
that is very validating.
It is.
Yeah.
It
Because this stuff is crazy, because it's so well covered up that the only way that it can seem from the perspective of the dominant narrative is craziness.
Exactly. And it's well, we're getting to the point where the whole celebrity thing has just is so over the top in terms of like who, well, just for an example, so just this past week, the Patriots won. You know, I don't follow the Patriots. I mean,
I don't even know what sport we're on, so.
Football.
Okay,
It's
yeah.
called, I call it the religion of sports. So the Patriots won, and for 3 weeks before they had the Super Bowl, they dominated all news. They even bumped weather reports to get more information about this Super Bowl coming up. And so they won, and they had the parade. A million people went to Boston. I mean, we can't get 10 people to march for peace, and we get a million people to wave to a celebrity. I mean, this something wrong with this picture, and I just feel that I don't know. I think one has to be so grounded. I don't the kids coming up who are in the millennial, they're not kids. I guess it would be X or the Z generation would be those born after 2000. I can't imagine the world that they're facing, Jason, and I don't know how to help them. I don't think I can, because I'm neurologically I'm wired differently than they are, for one thing. So we're not even perceiving the world, the same world.
No, that's right. I know. And yeah, the things that are appalling to us perhaps are not even being questioned by these coming generations.
Exactly.
And you can't necessarily tell them. We can't tell them to question them at all, but I mean, we can't necessarily even know that. Well, I don't know exactly. I mean, it's. I mean, I'm experiencing it more and more in terms of not just I don't necessarily interact with younger generations, certainly not exclusively, but even primarily. So even my own generation, say, in terms of the values that are becoming more and more. De rigueur, to use that French phrase, more and more alienated from them and more and more appalled by these values. So, but that to me is symptomatic. I mean, so I mean, I think my main focus is well, it's socio-psychological, really, but in terms of like, not so much, oh my God, look what the world is coming to, because all older people end up saying that, and it's just a useless lament, right? But look at what is happening in the world, and look at the possible reasons for it, like why the world is becoming the way it is, if it can be traced back. And this is kind of an interesting dilemma. I'll just finish the thought, but if it can be led back to trauma. And sexual abuse of children as a primary factor, and there's a general culture of abuse that prevents us from landing in our body and just being at home in our bodies, let's say, then that's a good reason to question all of these values and these movements and these, the denominating norms or what have you. But the flip side of that, of course, is that it's the opposite can happen, which is, well, or how can these things be so bad if they're created this wonderful, for people who are already inclined to think that what's happening is positive in terms of it leading to transcendence, let's say, whether it's space travel, physical transcendence, or whether it's transhumanism, or there are all these positivistic narratives now, and they seem to be incorporating trauma into them. As a sort of justification, it's a circular thing, saying, well, this value set and this end goal is positive, and therefore it doesn't matter that the trauma was behind it, because we've already agreed that it's a positive goal, and therefore trauma actually isn't bad either.
Well, that's almost in James's "Everything Goes and Nothing Matters." I mean, is that you're framing that statement in that kind of consciousness that it really doesn't matter because it's all going to come out in the end the way it's supposed to? I mean,
Which is very spiritual,
Well,
philosophical. I can't argue with it if you put it that
but it's like I still do believe that there is some, otherwise if we'd all be determinists. I mean, it would just all be, there's nothing that we could do to make any change. So what the hell?
But didn't, because what we touched on right at the start was how these the attempts to solve the problems can begin in the most benevolent way, but they'll still end up malevolent in the end, because there's something in us that there's something that gets that is hooked into that desire to fix things, which itself is compromised. It's so heavily compromised that
but
it
not only fix things but take credit for it.
To be the one that fixes,
to be the one that, that's why Trump has, you know, he was able to do in his platform to convey that message that he was going to fix things. He will take credit for it. I don't know if he'll take responsibility for not fixing it, but that was a message that people wanted to hear, that he was going to fix things.
But that's the message every candidate gives.
Of course, but he was more successful in getting that message across. But I still think that there is some element in us that does screw it up, because we're, you know, we want power, we want money, we want
sex,
fame, sex, you know, all the things that come with those three things.
Well, we want immortality.
But immortality, and that's the thing about the Chimera, because one of the lines that my character says, well, if organ transplants are, they're harvesting organs to be transplanted into humans, then that means that as everything is rotting away, you just get a new organ, and therefore that equals immortality.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that it? What other reason would you be driving down this road for transplants? You know, I mean, some things can't be transplanted at this point, but there's a lot of things that can be. And I mean, I have friends who've had double lung transplants, liver transplants, and they're not old. You know, they're in their 60s, so they might have 20, 30 more years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if everything goes well. But can they keep getting these transplanted as those wear out? I mean, it's just like the cryogenics, you know, like, why would you want to freeze your body when you're not looking that well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you die, why would you want to freeze it for immortality in that particular stage?
Yeah, well, I have an answer to that, I think. And I think it is something we can all relate to. I don't think it's about loving life so much that you just want to extend it indefinitely. I think there is a positive element there, but I think the stronger element is the fear of death, and that isn't just a instinctive primal fear. I think there's a more, because animals fear death, right? But they don't fear it conceptually, and they don't try and figure out ways to cheat it, whereas humans do. And I think there is something that we know at a really deep level, like, because it's in our cells,
mm-hmm.
that we have to face when we die, which is the truth of our lives. And I'm hesitant to put it so starkly, because this is religious rhetoric, and it's the very thing that's used to drive us demented, right, in the first place.
Exactly.
But there is some primal knowing that, there's going to be a reckoning when we die, and it's not some angry God. It's just all the filters that we've had in our lives to keep the unconscious unconscious and keep at bay the real impact of our actions, they're all going to be torn away, and we're just going to be left with all of that suppressed load of the unconscious. And that's really the definition of terrifying. I certainly feel that. I'm certainly aware of it. So if we could prolong our lives indefinitely, of course we could.
What is the longest life? 120 years? That's probably the Guinness record or something like that. And it's probably indigenous tribes, some aborigine or somebody from Siberia or something who's lived to be that age.
Yeah, by doing nothing, without, you know, just by living a harmonious life. Yeah.
Exactly. They didn't eat organically. They didn't.
Well, they probably did, actually. Yeah. But if... and it's a massive if, because requires maintaining the social and economic system we have indefinitely, which is absurd. But I mean, if you could extend a human life indefinitely through technology, then
Well,
yeah, then
that's
you're thinking thousands of years. Oh, that's lots of time to get enlightened. But of course, the ridiculous, or whatever, you know, to get clear of all the stuff that's going to haunt me when I die. Well, of course, that's, I mean, it's the inverse of enlightenment, because you're just pushing more and more down and getting more and more dissociated from your organic psychological reality.
Have you ever read Ernest Becker's Denial of Death? That was a classic. It was probably published in the early 70s.
Was my brother's Bible, so partly for
No
that reason I
kidding,
didn't read it.
But I mean that goes into the futile attempt to solve the problem of humanity, which is mortality. That's the basic problem of humanity, is mortality.
So where did that begin is the question, right? At what point did we decide, in quotes, that mortality was a problem? Like, and how? You know, what's the rationale for it being a problem? There isn't one, really, except
There isn't
I don't
one.
want to die.
But it could be better after. Do you know
Yeah, I
what I
mean.
mean? It's like we're looking at we want to anthropomorphize everything, you know, in terms of animals and anything that comes into our life, we have to make it a human thing. So we think that this is the best show in town. Well, it is the best show in this town, but we haven't been to the big town yet. You know, that's the way I look at it. I mean, and I don't live. The thing about it, Jason, is my feeling at this point in my life is I'm on the continuum of, I don't know how long. I don't even care about longevity. You know, if I wanted to, I don't even know if I ever wanted to live to be a certain age, but I'm already beyond that. You know, like even the Bible said, we're only entitled to 70 years. So I'm beyond that. But I don't, it's a certain, and I've been around because I was an ICU nurse for almost 10 years. Okay. I've been around. I was a military, I was a Navy triage nurse in Vietnam. I've been around a lot of dying, dead people.
You were in Vietnam?
Well, I was a Navy nurse during the Vietnam War, right? I did the ICU and I was on a ship for a little while, but most of my 2 year commitment was stateside because I wanted to. I was an idealistic nurse at that time, and I wanted to really use my skills. And there's no place like a war zone. But that I was soon disillusioned about that. But the thing is, I think that I don't know. It's because I don't know. It's not even an age thing, because I really have felt I have always felt this way about death. I've never been uncomfortable around it. I think part of it is, Jason, because I had a young brother, younger brother than me, who died at age 4. I was 7, and he died of leukemia, so it was fairly drawn out, although nobody survived leukemia back in the 40s. But the thing is, I remember going through Brian's death process, because he was dying the moment he was diagnosed. There was no cure for leukemia. And I don't know. I just didn't, it didn't strike me as something that I didn't want to do. At some point, I'm not, I wasn't going to commit suicide after he died, but I just felt there was, he kind of understood what the hell was going on too. I really do believe that he was here for a short while, and he made a huge impact on me, I'll tell you that. And maybe that was why he was supposed to be here. But
So you don't dwell on the future event of your death.
no, I don't. It's like I think Consular, it was very interesting. You've gotten Consular to talk about some stuff that I was very surprised. He doesn't talk about spirituality at all, because he's a true materialist. But the last podcast you had with him, he did talk about death.
Yeah.
And I think because he's, I think what he must be near 70 or he's up there.
Yeah.
And he's on the other end now. And he said he thinks less about death now than when he was in his 30s.
Yeah.
But he said he also felt he had accomplished something, that he had some kind of something to leave. And I feel kind of the same way. Like, I feel like, well, I've done what I'm supposed to have been doing, and I've done it. And whether I do any more of it, I don't think it really matters. I think, Jason, you've done what you're supposed to do, and I'm not wishing you an early demise, but, I mean, if you never do anything else for the rest of your life, take it easy.
Right. Yeah, well,
really?
I'm very divided that way. It just came out on the next podcast, actually, that I do feel at that level in terms of accomplishing stuff in a worldly sense, certainly a lot less than went back when I thought I was going to bring about the end of civilization, but that's okay,
right.
Because, you know, I've got my head straight around that. But
right.
Then there's a much deeper thing, and I do have a lot of dreams about this, which I could even call nightmares, but they're not really, because they're me becoming aware of something that I feel I need to become aware of.
Right.
And it has to do with you were talking about this thing, this desire to take credit, that part of us that needs to be a somebody and identify with what we do and with this life and somehow attain immortality. If it's taken to the most pathological extreme, it can be acted out in all of these awful agendas that I've been exploring, and
mm-hmm.
I know that's in me. I know it's in all of us, but I know it's quite strong in me because I was raised in that elitist environment, and probably, well, let's say, entrained through abuse to some extent. So I'm becoming more conscious of that. And one of the things I saw recently in a dream was that, insofar as I die with that part of me intact, I will be condemned to repeat this life over and over again for eternity. Okay, well, that may not be literally true, but there's something in it that had a profound resonance of truth to me.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, I've studied this with Strieber, like the worst thing you can do is drive yourself with the whip of, you know, the fear of damnation, because then all you do is create all the circumstances that ensure the very thing you're afraid of, and so on. You create that prison for yourself. But
right.
So I'm aware of that danger inherent in even seeing these kinds of perceptual realms, but that doesn't mean that they're unreal, right? It's a question of being able to see them and not attach the energy of fear to them, and the energy of doing, like, oh my god, I've got to fix it, I've got to get free before I die, you know.
Right.
But there is something. There's something there that lets me know that it's. I was just thinking about this today, actually. That on the one hand, it's very strange, because on the one hand, I can look at my life, present and past, and
mm-hmm.
say I've lived a good life, really, all told. But on the other hand, I can look at it through a different lens, and they're both real, and I can say the opposite. I haven't really lived. I've lived for myself, selfish interest, my whole life, and I don't want to die with that on my conscience, so to speak, that basically I've really lived for myself my whole life. And they're both true, and I think the difference is that one is a perception through the ego, the identity, which basically
right.
says I'm shit, it's all fucked
right.
up, I screwed up
right.
everything. And the other is a perception that's just through the body, really, and the soul, which
right.
is saying, no, everything is just the way it has to be. But the truth of that latter viewpoint depends on letting go of the ego.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, the truth of the latter part of that statement, in terms of you are moment to moment making decisions about how you're conducting your life.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing that I find that a lot of your guest speakers who are young have an uncanny awareness of that already, which I think is quite interesting. That Tom Mellett, well, of course, he's not young.
No, he's not young.
I think he's a little younger than me, but if he was in Rudolf Steiner College in the 70s, he's probably in his 60s, right?
I think so. I think late 60s, maybe.
But I think that everyone that I have listened to has really, I have what we call in public speaking a keeper. So there's been at least one keeper in all the podcasts I have listened to that I've taken away something of value.
So that, and that's to do with what you're talking about, this responsibility. We want our moments to be keepers. If we're going to
Right.
take them with us into eternity, we
Right.
want them to be keepers,
Right.
right? We don't want to be carrying around a bunch of duds.
The other thing I wanted to just mention that I'm looking at Garbanzo, right?
The picture,
Picture, right?
yeah.
Because I'm a cat person, and I know that I'm going to send you a collage because I know you usually make your own thing and you need some images because I didn't want this to be a video Skype, but I have a collage of the cats I've owned in the past 20 years. So it's called Hats and Cats. So it's me in various stages of my persona with the cats that have been in my life. And I have always recognized cats as really, as a matter of fact, is one of the things that drew me to Frida John was he said his first guru was a cat.
Oh,
And he
wow.
was at the theological seminary in New York.
Huh.
And it was a stray cat that moved in his neighborhood, and it became his guru. And so I had a feral cat come into my life when I was going through a real crisis. This was in the early 90s, when I was having another career change. And I had to euthanize that cat in 2012. He lived to be 23 years
Ah,
age.
that's great.
And I called him my golden guru. He was a tabby, gold, big, fluffy gold cat. And I wrote odes to him and everything because he just kept me, grounded into what was important. So I had a feeling that Garbanzo was had a similar place in your life as a teacher.
It's absolutely. I never considered him to be my guru, but then I never kind of
No,
used
I
that language. But in a way, it went beyond that because I
That was our
started to think that he was actually my soul
Okay. Yeah.
that had not been able to incarnate, that it had arrived in a cat package.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm taking artistic license only because I wrote an ode to Gold. His name, my cat's name was Goldfinger, and I referenced him as the Golden Guru.
Yeah.
But guru to me is not, you're right, it's actually, I don't consider it a positive acclamation.
Yeah.
But it's it cats are very interesting. And you have another cat, I understand.
Tuco, yeah, he came along very soon after Garbanzo. Like I didn't even have a decent mourning period, but it did seem that somehow that was the way that it was
Yeah.
meant to be, and he's
Right.
almost a dead ringer for Garbanzo. So it's been curious, like I, because one of the reasons I didn't want to just go out and find another cat as soon as
Right.
possible was because I wanted to go through the mourning period, but what happened was the Tuco did come into my life very soon after that, and he's quite different from Garbanzo, but physically he's almost the same. And so there is this feeling of not having to miss Garbanzo. And there was even a period where I thought Tuco was the reincarnation of Garbanzo, of course. I had to go there. And after I'd named him Tuco, I found out that the word Tulka is this Tibetan thing for exactly that. You know, when they're looking for the Dalai Lama, and then the next dive, it's called the Tulka. They're trying to find the Tulka. So I'm like, whoa, it really
Well,
is him.
where'd that come from? Right.
Yeah.
That's great.
But you
Well,
know, I don't really believe in reincarnation, but I do believe in something, and whatever energy was guiding me towards a deeper sense of love through Garbanzo is still with me, and it's partly
Oh,
with me through
absolutely.
Tuco, right?
After I had to go euthanize Goldfinger, I decided I couldn't. I didn't want any more animals, and I ended up fostering a friend of mine's cat for a year and a half, and it was supposed to be for 3 months, and then it was for a year, and then it was a year, and then that cat also ended up with a tumor in his lung,
Hmm.
so we had to put that cat to sleep. But I got as close to that cat as practically I did to Goldfinger, and it's just, and now I have no cats, Jason. And the only thing that's changed is I don't have to vacuum as much. But
So you don't feel more solitary?
I think I'm in a liminal place where, like, okay, I'm between cats. I would foster someone's cat if it came up. You know what I mean? It just happened to come up. I didn't go to the shelter or anything, and I used to use the cat as an excuse not to travel anymore because I hate airports. I hate crowds. I hate traveling. I hate the whole hassle of it
Oh, I
now.
used to travel with Garbanzo.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Well, I really okay.
All over the world, yeah.
But I just can't do the travel thing anymore. So The cat had nothing to do with it. It was just I used the cat as an excuse. Oh, I can't leave Goldfinger, and then I can't leave Bob, the last cat. But that has nothing to do with it. It's just that I just don't like airports, and I don't want to go through security, and I don't want to. Anyway, but that's where
Well,
we are.
I do want to did want to ask you a little bit before we go about Prisoner Infinity, because I'm getting it prepped for publishing. So I was going to send an email to you about it anyway, whether you
Oh,
wanted to
great.
read it and maybe review it or something.
Oh, that'd be great.
Are you familiar with the material or?
Well, I mean, I've gone to your, on your site where I've just had, I think you've published some stuff from it, right?
That's why I asked, because actually
Right.
the whole of it is already at the blog. It's just going to be recompiled and edited
Right.
as a book now.
And I actually do not like to read a lot of stuff on the internet. I like a book. I like the whole kinesthetic.
Same. It's a totally different
A total
experience.
different experience. So definitely I'd be interested in your book. Send me information about it. And now that I have your address, and I sure hope you get that check because it's a big one.
Oh, well, you can cancel it if it doesn't come.
But it was so funny
Now
because
you're gonna
I
have.
had sent you the check last week, and I listened to your podcast on Saturday, and you said something about, well, I haven't gotten any checks recently. Oh, that's right, it's 2017. I guess everybody's just in a crunch. And I thought it was funny because I just happened to do that. And it wasn't because you were having me on your podcast. It was just,
Well, I hope it's not too big, otherwise I might suspect that I'm being handled or compromised.
Oh, well, I don't think there's anything big enough for that. Jason. But I didn't put a tracer on it or anything, but
So did you have experiences of, while you were doing research and while you felt that you were participating in agendas that you gradually realized were not ones you wanted to partake in. Did you have a sense of being groomed at all, or of being getting close to something and being sort of tested for how willing you were to go to be included or brought into the loop? Did you ever have that sort of experience?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think that like this think tank group I was in, I was probably the farthest one out there, okay, in terms of conventional looking at the world through conventional perspectives, and I knew that I was not. I would do my part, but I knew that that wasn't where I belonged. And I think that has kind of always been why I have felt in a liminal space, is that I get excited and involved and do the research, and I realize that, like, even parts of my book I felt like were automatic writing because I don't even know where I got the information. And I mean, it was based, I mean, my research is based, my book was based on research, and it was early neuroscience. Of course, they weren't throwing that word around a lot at that time, but that's essentially what it was. And I felt like part of the writing wasn't even, I mean, I was like, it wasn't automatic writing, but I just felt like, where, why am I writing? It was like, where is this? What am I doing this for? Where is this going? And after I did it, it went, it's where it ended. It ended up in someone's hands who was at Harvard. And do you know what I mean? You don't know where it's going to end up, Jason. That's why you've got to do it.
Well, that could also be a reason not to do it.
Well, it could be, but I think that is the more compelling is. You can always, as I said, once I had done it, and then I thought maybe, okay, this is, I'm gonna, for several years, I did work in, I did work with colleges and communities that were trying to do LEED architecture and all that stuff. But by the time I was ready to, because this was a late, you know, this is like my got my doctorate, like probably earned it. I was in my 50s, and I didn't expect that I was going to be out in the workplace longer than 60.
Yeah.
I had means that I didn't need to work. I didn't need the income. And I didn't care about accumulation of that nature. So I just felt like, well, this is where I'm here right now. This is what I'm doing. I don't know where it's going to go, and it went where it went, and where it's going from there, I don't really have any attachment to it. So that's so I never was not I'm not a really I'm not a joiner person. You know, I got kicked out of the Girl Scouts early on, and as a matter of fact, someone sent me a picture of myself in the sixth grade. All right, and I asked a friend of mine to pick me out of this group of students. Of this, it was a co-educational. I went to a girls' school and for high school, but this was co-ed for junior high, and I said, pick me out of this class of 34 or whatever it was. And immediately they said, right there, second left in, up two rows. And I said, well, how did you know it was me? He said, even in the sixth grade, Susan, you had attitude. And I'm not kidding, Jason. I looked at the picture, and that is exactly, I'm like looking through at this camera with skepticism. And it was right there on my face, and that's how I think I've gone through my life.
Yeah, so yeah, that would make you, that would signal that you weren't going to be easy to handle or recruit or incorporate into agendas.
Right, exactly. And so and according to my relatives, you know, right from the time I could be vertical, I had my own mind. You know, and it wasn't like I was a spoiled brat or anything. It was just that I just knew, you know, I knew that I didn't know. I guess that would be the ultimate knowledge, that I knew. And I, you know, I tried to hang around with people who I could learn something from. And when I stopped learning something, I shift gears. So I never had children, never wanted children. I did get married, which was, you know, I married once, and I knew that would never happen again. And so, I mean, I just felt like I never took a conventional path in terms of, you know, being a conventional person. And I'm not as a snob. It's just that I just always knew that I was out of the box. And kind of glad of it, Jason, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, same, same. I do wonder myself, even if sometimes if the stuff I do could be being used for, you know, or could someday be used for unethical purposes. I mean, I'm not really doing a great deal of research or groundbreaking material in the usual sense, but I mean, just in terms of like, well, I guess it's back to that, the desire to nurture connections in the present time, in the
Yes.
present moment, and just keep the attention there. Because in terms of doing work that will have some sort of social impact, it's that's probably at best going to be a mixed blessing, I think.
Exactly. Because anyone can take your information and twist it if they want. They have their own agenda. And that's what I felt was happening to my work, that it was looked at in a different perspective. And
You mentioned MK Ultra, and you've done, obviously you said you've done some work in neurology and whatnot. So, how much has that helped you to understand MK Ultra, or do you is that just something you're only peripherally aware of, the MK Ultra
yeah,
practice?
well, I'm not, I mean, I'm aware of MKUltra, and I've read a little bit about it, and I understand, of course, the whole mind control thing, predated Nazis. They used it to their advantage, but I mean, it was that kind of, but I really believe that that is what's happening now with psychotropic drugs, and so many of the pharmaceuticals that are on the markets now are reprogramming and realigning neural networking. And actually, someone told me, this might be from Richard, whom I'm going to refer you to at the end of the podcast, or through email, whatever, that in the AI community in Silicon Valley, they are taking small doses of LSD on a daily basis. That was one of Steve Jobs' prerequisites,
Oh.
that to keep them creatively thinking out of the box. They are, and I know there's all kinds of stuff, brain stuff that you can see. You just go on the internet, and there's all kinds of pharmaceuticals out there to enrich your brain or make you genius or whatever. But someone had mentioned that they knew for a fact that LSD was part of the programming to in the AI community.
Wow.
And I suppose anyone who's done LSD, you have different perception. I mean.
Yeah, and I mean it's interesting because there's this recent findings, whether they're accurate or not, I don't know, but about how LSD works and how it's actually the opposite of what we were
Right.
generally taught to believe, and that it because it shuts off oxygen from the brain.
Exactly. Right. So it would have to give you a different perception. But I mean that you can get that from a sensory deprivation chamber.
Right, or being choked half to
Or
death.
I mean, right. There's many roads to the
So, I know you, I mean, you may not be, because if you haven't read Prisoner Infinity, but you might be familiar with the test. One of the things that Strieber cites as his sort of pièce de résistance in terms of understanding the communion or the alien contact experience is the how they traumatized rats for periods and saw how their brains got bigger. And that's what he's saying that the visitors are doing to him. They're making him smarter and better.
Well, parts of their brain got bigger.
Yeah.
Probably. Einstein's left parietal lobe was larger than anyone's.
Right.
That was one of the findings of Dr. Diamond.
I wonder if he was traumatized as a youth, because you're talking about these programs that predate the Nazis. Well, I would agree, and I think that there's one of the primary goals is traumatizing very young children in order to enhance their brain capacities.
So I don't know. It's still a mystery, Jason. I think it's an interesting exploration. And I'm in it until I'm not.
Yeah, and then you may still be in it.
Well, I may be. That's right. In a different configuration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Put this on the air, or if you go on the air, because I'm sure you don't, you probably don't post all of the ones that you.
Actually, it's almost never happened. In fact, I don't think it ever has. There's been times where somebody said, "No, you can't do it at the last minute," which is annoying, but I don't think I've ever said, "Brr, that one didn't work out." So you'd be the first. But you're not, so sorry.
All right.